This is Derek Bros. This is Derek Bros of the Conscious Resistance. I'm here in Standing Rock.
That man is wanted in 5 different countries: Chile, Argentina, Brazil.
We've been fighting a long time. We've all lost so very much. So many loved ones gone.
Don't you fucking tease that horse!
You are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important.
Hey everyone, this is Derek Bros with the Conscious Resistance Network, and today I'm bringing you two important guests to continue our conversation around COVID-19, the various debates that have been taking place for the last year. Dr. Andrew Kaufman, I spoke with last April. Some of you will remember when we first began this conversation about whether or not germ theory should be, you know, just discarded or should be, you know, continue to be supported in the mainstream. And most recently, last week, I had an interview with Dr. Mercola. We were speaking about a variety of topics, but when the topic of terrain theory versus germ theory and his thoughts on that, he mentioned my two guests today, Dr. Andrew Kaufman and Dr. Thomas Cowan. And, you know, he seemed to sort of dismiss the importance of some of the work they're doing. And I know that many of you listeners were very taken back by that and came to the defense of these two men, feel very strongly about their work, obviously. And I decided, well, let's go ahead and have them on and give them an opportunity to discuss this. So without further ado, I'd like to bring on Dr. Thomas Cowan and Dr. Andrew Kaufman. How are you guys doing today?
I'm doing well.
Good to see you, Derek. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. And first time for me to talk to Dr. Cowan, so I appreciate you guys making some time. Let's go ahead and get into it. So the topic, well, first off, like, I'll give you a chance to just immediately respond. What did you think about what Dr. Mercola said in reference to both of your work?
Well, I'll tell you, Derek, you know, I like to keep the conversation as scientific as possible and really look at specific points in the argument and keep it in that context. And, you know, I try never to resort to ad hominem or other tactics because, you know, that would just show a weakness in my argument. But I really think that, you know, I emphasize, and I think Tom probably agrees with this, the questioning of the what I call the virus dogma as a big part of the germ theory. And that's the most relevant right now. We can talk about, you know, bacteria and fungi in a separate conversation, really. But just focusing on the virus issue, it seems that the control system that wants to promote this globalist agenda of, right, and I think everyone agrees, all of the alternative health practitioners who are speaking out at present agree that there is this agenda to remove our freedoms and that the policies enacted do not fit the scientific evidence. But the reason why I feel it's so important to drill down to that deeper level of questioning the virus causing disease paradigm completely is because they basically have a recipe. And this is based upon an experiment done by John Enders in 1954, whereby they can pretty much create the appearance of an isolated virus with almost any illness. So for example, if you even gave me a laboratory, I think, and I had a couple of postdocs with me who have done these kind of experiments, we could take a small number, and I'm talking about 2 or 3 people with an illness, and from that we could do the same experiments and we could show a new virus by their means. And this has been done many times over, but this is the first time that they've taken it to such an extent to change all these policies. But we've seen a similar things with the, you know, swine flu and the original SARS and MERS, other alleged coronaviruses. And if they can simply recreate this game, like, for example, they're starting to do this currently with a so-called mutation in the virus, right, where once again, with really no prima facie evidence, they can say, okay, there's a new strain, it's more contagious, it's more deadly in South Africa, without any rigor, and then they can use that to justify more policies and keep this progression going. And we'll be held completely vulnerable to that situation until we can drill down to that layer and say, wait a minute, this is really all fabricated based on a misunderstanding, a misconception, and outright really poor and irresponsible scientific practice.
Dr. Cowan, would you like to respond to your thoughts on what Dr. Mercola said in this situation in general?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo everything Andy said, and also please call me Tom. The thing, if I have a quote agenda right now, is I, you know, I talk to a lot of people and I get interviewed a lot, and the real crux of this issue is how does a scientist or a virologist identify and isolate a new virus and then demonstrate that that new virus causes disease? That is the issue. Because if the so-called virus has never been isolated and identified, then you obviously can't do a PCR test, and it obviously isn't causing the disease. And so the whole game is over. Now, the thing that so concerns me about this is, you know, over and over again, I talk to people and they say to me, Tom, I'm 100% or 90% sure that the virus exists and is causing this COVID-19. And I say to them, how do you know that the virus exists? And they say, because a lot of people in China get sick, or a lot of people in a nursing home, or my Aunt Bessie went to a party and she got sick. And I point out that there is no scientist, no virologist, no competent medical doctor on the planet who would use that kind of evidence to prove the existence of a virus. None. Those are epidemiological observations. And the purpose of epidemiological observations in science is to generate hypotheses that can then be tested. After all, we've spent 200 years thinking scurvy was an infectious disease because one person after another on a boat got it, and then somebody gave somebody a lime to eat and the whole thing went away. So this actually matters. So after I get done pointing out that that's not the way we prove a virus exists or causes disease, I then say, do you know how a scientist would go about this? And invariably, the answer is no. Now, if a person who's asking somebody a question doesn't even know how you would go about demonstrating whether it's true or not, you are in a compromised position, because they can say anything they want and you don't know how to ask them questions. I'm not talking about you in particular. I'm talking about all the people I've talked to. So The thing that's happening here is the population, and including journalists and podcasters and other interested parties, which is basically everybody, has come to the conclusion that this is so complicated to understand that we should outsource it to virologists, because even medical doctors, they have no idea how you isolate, purify, characterize, and demonstrate a virus causes disease. And frankly, I didn't know either until I got pushed into this situation, and I had to know. It turns out that every reasonable human being, and I can describe it to you if you want, can determine whether this virus A, has been isolated, B, exists, C, has been characterized, and D, has been shown to cause disease. In literally, Derek, in 10 minutes, you will know everything you need to know if we decide to go that route. And I think what happens then is then you don't have to believe me, and even though I tend to believe Andy because everything I've heard from him seems to be accurate, you don't even have to believe Andy. You can believe your own sense and your own intellect and your own understanding. Because I can guarantee, I know how smart you are. I know you can get this in 10 minutes.
The important thing is that you have to first ask those questions though, Tom, right? And most people are just really not asking those questions. They're taking it for, you know, as truth, because, you know, we've all believed that all our lives, right? That these things are caused by viruses.
Right. So it's kind of like, as I described in my book, I mean, and I don't know any other way to describe this really, it's as if we're under a spell. And because we're under a spell, and that happens because of fear or conditioning or, you know, a lot of things, they somehow convince themselves that they can't understand the simple human idea of how do you isolate one thing from another? And it's very simple.
Sure. You know, I'm with you guys on this, and I definitely want to go down that road, Tom. I do want to, before we start getting to the specifics, I want to address one more thing that Dr. Mercola said, because obviously the focus of today is going to be on the isolation of COVID, you know, where the mainstream claims folks like you and others are wrong. This is fake news. Here's the examples we can point to where it's been isolated. And I know that both of you have done some work to kind of call out these various papers that say, look, here it is. So I want to get into that. But I also would like you just, I guess, your personal view, which I think is pretty self-evident. When Dr. Mercola said that he believes ultimately that this conversation is irrelevant, that it's divisive, it's, you know, it's not going to be helpful to reach people, those sort of things. What are your thoughts on that? Like, if is this something we should think about strategically, or do you think that was just kind of too dismissive of a very...
So you clicked off a little bit, but I think you addressed that to me. As Andy said, if we don't get this right now, and I mean right now, then we're going to go down this road again and again and again. Because unless people understand how you actually demonstrate that this thing called a virus causes disease or not, then the situation really is desperate and hopeless. So in my mind, this is the only show in town.
You know, this is really, really the key issue, as I kind of open with, because we're held hostage to more and more viruses or mutations of this virus that can be used to manipulate us over and over again and take away our freedoms. And until you look at this issue itself, you'll be held hostage to that. And think of all the fear that is falsely created by being afraid of something that you can't control, right? Because the virus is an invisible particle that comes from outside of yourself, when in reality, you'd have almost full control over your health by the decisions you make and the behaviors that you carry out.
So let's move now to the topic of conversation, which is really the main reason that we brought you guys here today. And that is the issue over whether or not COVID-19 has actually been isolated in some form or another. I'm showing on screen now for those who are going to be listening to this. We're going to show a few fact checks on the screen. This one's from the Associated Press. Posts falsely claim COVID-19 virus has not been isolated. And this one's a fairly general one that I know you guys have already covered. Essentially, it's just saying it was first isolated by the Chinese on January 7th, according to the World Health Organization. This one is from Reuters. Fact check, the virus that causes COVID-19 has been isolated and is the basis for the vaccines that are currently in development. This is from about a month ago, and kind of a similar thing. It's just saying that, well, no, it was identified by Chinese authorities on January 7th, and this has now become the basis for the Pfizer, BioNTech, Oxford, AstraZeneca, and Moderna vaccines. Another one here, this is not a fact check, but this is a paper that I've had people send to me, and I'm sure you guys have seen as well. Identification of coronavirus isolated from a patient in Korea with COVID-19, February 2020. This is another thing. Yeah, I'm just showing on screen for those who are listening. Common, I think, retorts that I'm sure you guys have seen, both Tom and Andy, when people say, no, in fact, it has been isolated. Here's the evidence. This one, novel SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus was isolated, and Friuli Venezia Giulia 2, I can't pronounce that, I apologize. But it's basically giving another example where they claim it has been isolated. The first two results came from completing sequencing of the genomes, which make it possible to study the evolution of coronavirus over the course of pandemics. And then another one, the COVID-19 virus has been isolated many times, according to fullfact.org. And this is another kind of fact-checking website. It claims COVID-19 has been isolated many times. It does not adhere to Koch postulates as it is a virus, and Koch rules have been widely disregarded now. COVID-19 PCR tests are generally very accurate. And obviously that PCR statement is false, but I'll leave you gentlemen to kind of address this before I get into the links that you sent to me, Andy. What are your initial thoughts on this? That it's been isolated by the Chinese, it's been isolated many times, it's been isolated from a patient in Korea.
Yeah, well, Derek, I definitely have, seen most of those articles, and I'm sure Tom has read them as well. And you know, actually, that's one of the most important things, is that you actually spend the time to read these articles so you can understand what's going on. But I want to, you know, just give a little bit of wisdom just to frame this discussion, because back in the day, I had a startup company, a technology company, and I had this successful mentor from his past. And he would always start off meetings by saying, we have to know what things are things. And I think that that is really the starting place in this question, because we're talking about that there's a claim made that there's a brand new organism, right, a virus that's never been known to exist before. So just think about it. If you were going to discover something brand new that's never been known to exist before, how would you know that you discovered it? Well, you would have to actually have the thing, right, in your hand by itself, where you could look at it and say, okay, this is what it is. And, you know, then you can do all kinds of experiments on it to characterize it, to sequence its genetic material, if it has any, tell exactly what molecules it's made of, and all the things like that. But if you don't actually have it first, then you can't do that, or you can't say that it's even a real thing. And so these so-called isolation experiments, what we're really talking about is that process. So there are claims from those articles, and you'll see right in the title of the article, it says, you know, things like a novel coronavirus was isolated. But what you have to do is you have to look a little bit deeper, because the word isolation, in the way that virologists use it in those published papers, doesn't mean what I was talking about, where you have a thing by itself that you can characterize it and say that it's a real thing. And so we can get into the nitty-gritty of exactly how they do the experiments, but the two links that I brought up, I think, really help frame the context of this. So the one paper is a very, very famous paper from a very prestigious journal, PLOS-1, from Professor John Ioannidis. And he's the Stanford mathematician and epidemiologist who is very prominent and well-respected in mainstream academia. And basically, he wrote this editorial saying that, you know, actually not even saying, he's trying to explain why this is true, that it's already been shown to be true, that more than half, or in other words, most published research findings are false. So we have the context here that when we look at these virology papers, that they also may be in that majority of false findings. Okay, so that's a very mainstream approach to look at it. And I would, you know, strongly suggest that everyone, when you read a scientific paper, that you read it with skepticism. And that's really the spirit of scientific inquiry, that you're always supposed to question and challenge whatever is put forth before you. And then the second article I mentioned is from The Off Guardian. Now, this may be a little bit more of a controversial source, but the only thing that I want to point out in there, and this is an article about the PCR test that was written by Torsten Engelbrecht and his co-author. But what they did is they actually corresponded with the authors of those papers you mentioned, Derek, like the paper that was published in the New England Journal from the Chinese group. And asked them, did you actually purify the virus particles? So that's a word that's incontrovertibly means to separate from other things and have alone by itself. And they asked the question in a couple of different ways, like, did you have any procedures that did this? And did any of the microscopic images that you displayed show a purified virus? In other words, were all you had in a test tube or in a sample or a petri dish was just the virus particles by themselves. And I think there were four different authors from four different papers that all claimed to isolate the virus. And all of them admitted that they did not purify or separate from other things the virus particles. So they're having to basically use a kind of a trick to change the meaning of the word isolate to make a casual reader, like a typical doctor who would, you know, see articles and curated by some organization like WebMD, they would just see the titles of the article and they would think that the virus really was separated and isolated according to the definition of the word isolate that they know. However, that's been completely obfuscated in these papers by coming up with this false definition of isolation, which really means to grow a toxic cell culture and then show cell damage.
So I want to just comment here before I give Tom a chance to respond to that. So what I'm showing on the screen now is, again, the study that someone sent to me and has been shared plenty of times regarding the isolation from a patient in Korea. And so what I'm reading here under their methods, it says that they took a sample from putative patients with COVID-19 that were inoculated onto cells to isolate the virus. Full genome sequencing and electron microscopy were used to identify the virus. And at the same time, the article you point out from Off Guardian, where they said they made an attempt to reach out to various authors, it does include this study. And when asked about this, the answer they received on March 19, 2020, we did not obtain an electron micrograph showing the degree of purification. So they say they did not obtain electron micrograph showing purification. And then on this sentence, it says they use an electron microscopy to identify the virus. So I think what's important, and what I would like for either of you gentlemen to distinguish, and I think you were kind of already getting to this, but distinguish the difference, the scientific meaning between purification and isolation.
It's quite simple, Derek. So the word purification and isolation almost mean the same thing, really. It's only in virology that they change this. So in other words, if you look at a chemistry paper where they say we've isolated caffeine from coffee beans using some kind of extraction procedure, that would actually be the real meaning of the word isolation. So it's only in virology they have changed this meaning. And what they mean is that they mixed it with a cell culture and various toxic chemicals and then showed that those foreign cells in the culture are damaged and make particles. That's the experiment that they call isolation. So I really don't know how they apply that word to it, to be honest with you. But it's really a unique circumstance just in virology, not throughout science. But you can look these words up in a dictionary, you know, and see that they essentially mean the same thing. Right, Tom, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I started this by saying, Derek, that I was going to get it so that you understood exactly what we're talking about here. So I think
let's do it.
We're a little too far down the road, and what I think is going to happen is that you may end up still being confused, and I don't want that. I want you to know exactly what we know so that you can decide for yourself who's correct. If we could do that.
I'm following you so far. I want to just really be able to outline this, and I do want you to go down that road, Tom, because I know that I have listeners who are already on board with you guys, and I have listeners who think that you're crazy. And I have listeners who have no idea what's what, you know, so just that's why I'm asking these very simple questions to get to distinguish between purification, isolation. And I definitely would like you to, you know, you said you can make it as simple as possible. So please, you know, I just wanted to clarify that definitely we have audiences coming at this from different.
Right. So if Derek, I could use you as a foil here, and somehow Andy is frozen. So I don't know if that's a problem, but So let's just take this step by step, because that's my method of understanding the world. So the first thing is, and again, I would appreciate if I say anything and you don't agree or don't understand, that you stop me and so we can clarify. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
Okay. First of all, can we agree that a virus is a thing? And what I mean by that, it's not a thought or a feeling or an esoteric idea. It's an actual physical thing.
That's what I've been taught, yes.
Okay. Now, let's take another example, the one sort of Andy said. And I want you to pay attention to the words that I use because it's important. So we want to do an experiment to see whether the caffeine isolated from a coffee bean causes high blood pressure. So in other words, we want to isolate in the usual sense of, I have a pencil here and I isolate the pencil. So that's the only thing I have is this pencil, right? You with me?
Yep.
So we take the coffee beans and we grind them up and we put them in a capsule and we give it to 10 people and then we give an appropriate control and all 10 people have high blood pressure who took the ground coffee bean. Have we now proven that the caffeine in the coffee beans causes high blood pressure?
I guess if you're saying you're controlling for other factors, then you probably narrowed it down at least.
So I would question that because I don't think you know that the only thing in ground up coffee is caffeine. In fact, I would actually submit that until you prove that, there's likely to be fibers and caffeic acid and aromatic oils and a whole host of other things.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So we need to take this a step further. So we take that ground coffee bean that has a lot, maybe even hundreds or thousands of different things in there. And again, our quest is, does the caffeine in coffee beans cause high blood pressure? So we put it through a filter paper and that collects all the fiber and the cells or whatever else is in the ground part. And you end up with what we call coffee, right? And then we give that to 10 people, we give them an appropriate control. Have we now proven that the caffeine in the coffee causes high blood pressure?
Sounds like we're getting closer.
We're getting closer, but I think, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's anybody who thinks that that the only thing in coffee is pure caffeine, right?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Right. And certainly I'd love to see that proven. So again, we have to take it to the next step. And so now we can put it through a centrifuge or flow cytometry or some sort of device, which we can easily do, and we can spin it out. And so you get a band that contains only caffeine. Now, the next thing you do is you send that to an independent lab and you tell them the steps that you did. I ground the coffee at 10 RPMs a minute. I put it through a filter paper and the pore size was this. And then I spun it again in a density centrifuge and it created this band and I sucked the band out with a pipette. I looked at it under a microscope and I looked at it in a chemical analysis. And the only thing I have in there is caffeine. I can prove it. And 10 other people who all do the same thing will find the same single molecule. And then I give it to 10 people. They all get high blood pressure. 10 who don't, give them a placebo. It's a controlled experiment. They don't get it. Have I now proven that the caffeine in coffee beans causes high blood pressure?
I would think so. I mean, that sounds much more rigorous than where we started.
Yes, I would agree. Now, what about, Derek, if I took the coffee and I've mixed it in a vat that has chocolate and tea and yerba mate, and there may be other things that have caffeine in it. And I swirled it up and I cultured it for a day. And then I pulled out the caffeine from that. Would I still be able to say that the caffeine from coffee beans causes high blood pressure?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Because you don't know where the caffeine came from.
Exactly.
So that's what I mean. That's how a human being understands isolation. And when I say that's how a human being understands isolation, I would go so far as that is the only way to isolate. Now, it's different. Like if I want to isolate a pen from a pencil, I don't have to do all those steps. I can just remove the pencil and I have an isolated pen. And then I can study the pen. Now, I've looked at 31 different studies, although it may not be the right number because some of them I may have done twice or I might have missed some, all who said they've isolated this virus. And then I heard the other day, 125,000 times it's been isolated. I can tell you, and I am willing to, at this point, retract my book if any one of them did that procedure I just said, which means you take the snot from somebody with COVID and you grind it up just like you do with coffee. And then you put it through a filter paper of known pore size. And that's called the supernatant. And then you put that in a density ultra centrifuge device. And it comes out in a band. And then you suck out the band with a micropipette. And you show that that's all you have is this one virus. Then you inoculate or you expose an animal or a person to that one virus, which you now know you have nothing else. And that experiment has never been done. Now, it was done in the 30s and 40s when they invented the light microscope, the electron microscope. And what they found is this isolated, purified particle didn't cause any disease in any animal or person they studied, not once. And if anybody can show me a single study showing that that definition, which is the common human scientific definition of isolation with a virus causes disease, I will retract the book. Now, how did these people, that these papers that you show, do that? So here's what they did. They take somebody with COVID sometimes they just take a culture. They grind it up, just like the coffee bean. They put it in a filter, and then they have this unpurified brew, and then they stick it on a monkey kidney tissue, and nothing happens. So then they starve the tissue, and nothing happens. And then they poison the tissue with gentamicin and amphotericin, and then the tissue breaks down into thousands or hundreds or millions of particles, all of which have the same genetic material as the so-called virus, because there is only one, you know, building block of genetic material. It's like putting something in a vat of caffeine. And then they say, this particle is the new virus, and it's absolutely pure nonsense. And I hope after that, Derek, you can then read a paper. And if you see that they took the supernatant from ground up cells or snot, that's not purified. And if they inoculate it onto kidney cells, tissue, and it breaks down, and then they take some pictures of it showing a bunch of stuff in the background, that is not what any normal human being calls isolation and purification. And every single one has been that way. And therefore, the challenge stands. Show me, why can't they just take somebody, grind up their snot, filter it, centrifuge it, show us the picture, put it on an animal and show they get sick? Then I can go home and garden for the rest of my life instead of doing this nonsense.
I appreciate that breakdown, Tom. And I know you had something to add, Andy. So I just want to kind of say about that. So is it simply a matter of semantic word games and, you know, spells, as you kind of put it earlier, or is it literally that in the field of virology, they define it in a different way?
No, it's not that at all. It's that they discovered after 20 years of proper isolation, like I described, right? They took chickenpox lesions, they ground them, they filtered it, they centrifuged it, they found it. It doesn't even mean actually that it's a virus, really. It could be something from the inside. But let's forget, that just complicates the matter. And then they inoculated it on animals and they didn't get sick. And they essentially at that point said, we should go home. There's nothing to this. Let's be plumbers. And then they did an analysis and found that plumbers make a lot less money than virologists. So they decided to do what Andy described, which is to put it on noxious tissue cultures. And this paper that Andy appropriately describes, when you read Ember's paper, he says, actually, we have no idea whether these particle breakdown products are even coming from the vero, meaning the kidney tissue, or from the outside. They have no idea of that. And so this is the whole shooting match. This is everything, because if this is based on a fraudulent understanding of science and biology, then you can't, and Andy could describe exactly how they go from this to making a quote theoretical genome of a quote theoretical virus, it's scientific nonsense. I don't know how else to describe it. And then I'll let Andy go. Excuse me for going on so much.
Well, no, full analysis, because, you know, just kind of putting it in layman's terms and the analogy about, you know, what is purification and isolation really helps clarify. And I don't really have a lot to add, but I do want to say that the procedure that you describe, which is the proper way to purify and isolate particles, has been done more recently than in the 1940s, but not with viruses, because they know that that will not yield the result that they're looking for based on past research. But in the field of exosome research, and, you know, to remind the audience, exosomes are particles that are virtually have the same physical and chemical properties as what they say disease-causing viruses are, but they're made by our own cells in response to some kind of stressful situation like exposure to a toxin or radiation. And in experiments, scientists have been able to do those exact procedures that Tom outlined. In fact, that you can find articles that just describe methods to purify exosomes out of body fluids. So they're able to use these isolation procedures. They're well established. They're not new. They've been done successfully for other types of particles in the past. So there's no excuse not to apply it to these alleged disease-causing viruses, other than experience tells us that they will get negative results and won't find a disease-causing pathogen using the proper methods.
Have either one of you, has any, the thing that we call a virus, as Tom was describing earlier, have any of those ever been isolated?
That's a good question. Let me read you something here, if I can find it. I may not be able to find it, but it was from an article in Viruses, which, believe it or not, there's a magazine or a journal called Viruses, and it was July 2020. I don't have it right in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase. It's not an exact quote. And I don't remember the exact title, but it had to do with extracellular vesicles, exosomes, and viruses, and the difficulty of separating the two. Andy probably saw this because I sent it to him. And the bottom line conclusion. So here's the context. A virus is a outside pathogen that comes to, quote, infect you, versus an exosome, which is made by your own tissues or cells when you've been injured, as a detoxification and even potentially a communication mechanism. And they say quite clearly, and again, if I had the quote, I would read it, but I'll paraphrase. There is no technique now in modern science, modern virology, to separate an exosome, in other words, a particle coming from within you, from a virus coming from the outside. And the reason for that is, I tell all my friends, the only reason you can't separate this pencil from this pencil is because they're both pencils. And it turns out that all of these particles are generated from the inside. All of them. There are no pathogenic viruses. There are no disease-causing viruses. These are the result of toxins and stress and fear, and, you know, you can go on and on about the things that cause your body to say, I've been poisoned. I package up this, you know, genetic breakdown into a little package. These are called exosomes. They are the nature's way of communicating what has happened. And somehow we end up with a misconception called a pathogenic virus, and the world is being killed literally because of this misconception. And so anybody who says this misconception is not the most important thing to understand, I just don't know what they're talking about. This is the entire gig right here. If these are not pathogens, then why are we putting masks on? And why are we social distancing? And why are we making, quote, vaccines, which are not vaccines? And when you said, when you read that thing that, here's that, that Pfizer is using the virus as a template. That's not what Pfizer says. I'll read you what Pfizer says about their mRNA vaccine. Quote, the DNA template used does not come directly from an isolated virus from an infected person. Here's another quote. The DNA template, SARS-CoV-2, gene bank, et cetera, was generated via a combination of gene synthesis and recombinant DNA technology. So if this is a hoax that Pfizer doesn't have the virus as their template, then apparently Pfizer is in on the hoax.
So before we get into exosomes, because I know Andrew has more to say on that. So, you know, there's going to be some of this. So are you saying herpes doesn't exist? Are you saying, you know, this, the, you know, what smallpox, whatever list you want to get in, as far as we're talking about pathogens and things that people are traditionally.
Doesn't exist. What we're saying.
Well, I'm saying that as far as them being a virus, like, as you know, that you're saying that that virus, or what we people have been told for any number of illnesses, you know, it's caused by this external thing. That is false.
That is false. And instead, all I can say to all those people is show me a proper study in a published medical journal where they isolated the virus, as Andy said, as you can do. It's not difficult. And then they introduce that in a normal way into an animal. Now, just let me say here, when they supposedly use this liquid to create pneumonia in these monkeys, what they don't tell you is the way they say they did a nasal inoculation. You know what a nasal inoculation means? It means they anesthetized the monkey, turned it upside down, put a high pressure spray gun into their lungs, sprayed a bunch of unpurified stuff, and that supposedly means the virus causes illness. So if you can show me one study where an isolated herpes virus causes the disease called herpes, I will retract the book because we can't find it. Now, I didn't say that herpes doesn't exist. I didn't say that shingles doesn't exist. Obviously, it does. That's not the issue. The issue is whether an isolated virus is the cause. Now, even if I don't necessarily know what the cause is, I can tell you, I know it's not that virus.
So Derek, I would agree with Tom on all those points. I did want to add to answer your question earlier about, you know, has a virus ever been isolated? And before I answer that though, in the way that a different way that I want to just differentiate the word virus and what, because it's very confusing, what are you actually referring to? So what I would like to just substitute is the word particles. So have particles that can only be seen on an electron microscope, you know, been isolated in any context? And I would say yes. So they have found particles called bacteriophages that live in like bacteria cultures in a pure culture in laboratory conditions. And also they have found particles of that size in other lower organisms like sea algae. And I think they call those giant viruses actually. And those particles are quite interesting. And I would encourage you, I wish I had thought of this before, to find some photographs of the microscopic images of these particles, because they have very, very distinctive geometric forms. They don't just look like a round blob like the pictures of the alleged viruses that cause disease. But these bacteriophages and giant viruses, and so I don't think any of those are the microscopic images. There is, I know on Stanford University, they do have a good page that shows some of these. These look like computer graphics mostly, images. And that's another problem, you know, that a lot of the images you might see that are allegedly viruses are really computer graphic images created, you know, by an artist and not actual microscopic images. But if you look at actual microscopic images of bacteriophages or these algae related, you know, that they call viruses, but they don't cause disease in the algae, and they don't cause disease, I believe, in the bacteria either, although they were originally thought to eat the bacteria. But these have been readily purified. And so, for example, with bacteriophages, and really the idea that a disease-causing virus is an organism with genetic material really came from bacteriophages before the 1950s, mid-50s, really. The idea of a virus was that it was some kind of protein that was poisonous, that it wasn't an organism at all. They just thought it was a toxic material, and they thought it might be able to self-replicate. But the idea that it was a particle or that it contained genetic information wasn't conceived really until after bacteriophages became a sort of a model. But you can find dozens and dozens of papers where they isolate and purify bacteriophages out of bacterial cell cultures. And that you can look at a microscope image where all you see wall to wall are phage particles. And they have this very characteristic look. It almost looks like an alien ship of some sort. And they always have this kind of geometrical configuration. So it's easy to tell that that's really a thing because of the way that it's been, you know, purified and that it's been shown, and it's very distinctive visually. In the other types of particles that we're talking about, which include exosomes, it includes the so-called particles that they say are disease-causing viruses, and also includes other types of particles that of cellular breakdown, like apoptotic bodies and other ones that may not even have names. All of these are indistinct. They have a large range of size. They're all pretty much shaped in a spherical blob that, you know, may perturbate as it moves. But there's nothing distinctive about this. Even the so-called spike protein granules that they show in these, you know, images with these false papers, you can find lots of particles that have those types of granules around the edge there, and they're probably an artifact of the staining and processing of the tissue. But they're not distinctive. They've never been separated out and characterized what this protein, like no one has purified the spike protein in a laboratory and has a vial with the spike protein and has the X-ray crystal structure and has the amino acid sequence. As Tom read from the genetically modification vaccine manufacturer, Pfizer, that they didn't even get the sequence from a sample of the virus, right? So when we're talking about that, this, they say that the genome, you know, the full sequence of the genetic material of the virus has been determined. That's not true at all. What they have is a theoretical computer model of a genome of something that, so in other words, if you were to sequence the genome of an organism, right, you would have the organism, you would separate the nucleus out if it was a higher organism, and you would take the genetic material out in its pure form, and then you would sequence it. But that's never been done because, as we've described, the virus particle has never been separated where they could extract the genetic material from it. So what they did was they just took tiny little snippets or fragments of genetic sequences that were in the snot of sick people. And they used computer models and targeted sequencing probes, basically based on a database that has, you know, so-called viral sequences that are from other experiments that are done the same way. So it's all basically generate a lot of supposition in these sequences. And so they pull out these sequences, and then of course, they're not a continuous sequence. So how do you piece them together? So basically a computer runs for several days trying to piece these things together in some theoretical framework that fits the parameters of whoever set up the operation. So they say, oh, well, it's gonna have a spike protein and it's gonna be at this point. So then the computer fills in sequences, who knows where they're from, that were from, you know, somebody's snot, And then when there's missing gaps, the computer just makes it up. Like they may pull it from something in a database from another virus, or just generate it based on a pattern recognition algorithm, right? So essentially it's just a theoretical model. And sometimes it's even referred to in the literature as an in silico model, right? Meaning that it's made in a computer on circuitry. It's not a real genome of a real organism. And anyone that, you know, purports it to be, they should just simply look at the methods. This is roughly called next generation sequencing, which can be a powerful technique, but it's only really when sequencing known organisms with known sequences. And that's why essentially you have this theoretical construct. And so Pfizer is using this theoretical computer model of a sequence of a hypothetical virus to make basically what they call a vaccine, but it's not really a vaccine because it basically is a device to genetically modify our cells to make some foreign protein, which is based on this theoretical computer model, not based on an actual sequence from an actual organism. So that's, you know, there's so much confusion in how this is done, and it's very difficult to parse out, but this is really the procedure that they're doing. And it's really, you know, just kind of a big quagmire.
And just let me say, Derek, the only thing I'm going to add to that is that's actually what the papers tell you they're doing. Now, I don't know if people are waiting for like somebody to call them on the phone and say, by the way, we made this up, because I don't think that's going to happen. But let me read you from the most important paper written on the COVID-19 situation by Christian Drosten and others on where he got the genome or where he got the PCR segments that they're using in their test. And he says, and I'm quoting here, "We aim to develop and deploy robust diagnostic methodology for use in public health laboratory settings without having virus material available." Now, I don't know how much clearer they can make it that they never actually had possession of a virus. They never had possession of a genome. This is exactly, Derek, like if I said to you, I want you to make an exact replica of King Beauregard's castle from 1200 out of Lego. So there you go. And I say, here's all the Lego pieces in the world. And you have to make an exact copy. I'll give you $1 million if you can do it. And most people would then say, can you show me a picture of the castle? And I say, no, you have to make an exact replica, but you can't have a picture of the castle. Anyways, I'm going to give you $1 million. So you start looking. And then you find a moat, and then a turret, and then a flag. And you say to yourself, I know that moats belong to castles. And then you publish a paper on moats, and you get a prize for finding the moat protein. And then you get 10 different pieces, you put that into a computer, and it generates the castle, and you say, now I found the castle. And then everybody for 50 years argues over whether it's the right castle or not. And that's where we're at. And then eventually the guy comes back and says, oh, by the way, King Beauregard, he was afraid of snakes, so he lived in a townhouse in London.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate both of you kind of outlining the use of computer models and how much not only is it based on false claims about isolation and you know, purifying, but also the fact that this is not the first time, I guess we could say, this is not the first incident in American history, in recent American history, where we've seen stories being put forward based on computer models. You know, any number of incidences we can think of. So I appreciate that. And Andrew, one thing I did want to bring up briefly before we start to wrap up, I do have a couple more questions for both of you, some that were sent to me by the audience. I just want you to address a little bit about how I mean, because the reality is this, is that your take on exosomes is outside of the mainstream, to say the least. Exosomes exist, of course. That's a term that people, that, you know, it's a thing, like Tom was saying earlier. But the role that exosomes play, or that you have suggested they might play, does differ from what we hear in the mainstream discourse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, wait a minute. Derek, you're not suggesting that because it's part of the mainstream discourse, therefore it's true, are you?
No, not at all. But I want people to be able to distinguish between what they're going to hear from the fact checkers in the mainstream. Once the word exosomes is brought up, somebody's going to run to a fact-checking website, and they're going to search exosomes, and they're going to see Andrew's picture, and they're going to say, this guy falsely claimed this. So I do want him to have an opportunity to share, you know, why your view does differentiate what they call exosomes and the role that you think they play. Either of you, actually.
Yeah, Derek, no, I can clear that up pretty simply, because in reality, actually, what I say about the existence of viruses and their ability to cause disease is very against the mainstream, right, as obvious. But actually, what I'm really saying about exosomes is right in line with the mainstream virologists and exosome researchers, which is really what I said was that the images that they show in virus isolation papers, that the particles they're saying are the virus could very well be exosomes. And there's no way to differentiate. And the reason for that is backed up in the literature, because there are papers that show that cells exposed to antibiotics make exosomes. And there are lots of pictures of exosomes, and you can find ones, as I showed in a presentation, that look virtually identical to the virus particles, including what they say are coronavirus particles. So if you create this cell culture experiment that we talked about, the, you know, so-called isolation experiment with the kidney tissue from monkeys, they put antibiotics in there. So those kidney cells are going to make exosomes. So what I simply pointed out is that when you look at the microscope images, how do you know those particles are not exosomes, the ones that they say are virus particles? Because there's no specific label that would differentiate them. They don't put a stain with antibodies that would differentiate, you know, some chemical property, because they haven't characterized the chemical properties. So this is consistent with articles like Tom pointed out earlier, where there's no way to definitively separate exosomes from so-called viral particles, and other researchers who have stated, like in the context of HIV, for example. I know that I quoted this James Hildreth before, and I know that he even said that he believes that COVID is real, but he didn't say that. He didn't retract his quotation from the paper where he said the virus is the exosome in every way. Now, he was talking about HIV specifically. I agree, and I'm pretty sure I put the reference for that. But there are many papers you can find that draw comparisons between exosomes and viruses in the literature. And even when, see, now, when they, since they actually purify exosomes, they can actually extract pieces of genetic material from purified particles, and they can show what it is. And I believe they've even had papers where they've found sequences that they say are viral based on prior experiments present in exosomes, just as they found it in our nuclear genetic material. Now, I would interpret that as the reason it's there is because that's actually our own genetic sequences, and there's no foreign virus genetic material that has come into our body. But nonetheless, if you can do this experiment, you know, these researchers have, you know, really, I didn't even have the idea that exosomes and viruses were similar. I heard Tom mention it, and I remembered reading papers earlier in my career that made that comparison. And when I went and looked into the literature, there I saw the exosome researchers and virologists themselves talking about the similarities and overlaps. So I simply applied that to the COVID isolation papers and made some observations that put into question the validity of their findings. And I think really, you know, it would be hard to get any exosome researcher to disagree with that, because they've written that in all their papers.
I actually found the quote. It says, however, this is from a a journal called Viruses, July 2020, quote, however, to date, a reliable method that can guarantee a separation of viruses from exosomes does not exist. So it's not Andy Kaufman saying this alone. Andy is just understanding the true science here.
I appreciate that, Tom. I would definitely love to see that link as well. And I, you know, I don't mean to pin it on Andy or either of you. I know you two aren't alone in kind of putting these facts forward, but clearly, you know, you guys have taken the brunt for, you know, for talking about these topics and being fact-checked. And I do appreciate you taking the time to just spend a little bit of time going through each of these areas, because I do think it's important. And I know that my audience will have questions. While some are ready to believe that this is a hoax and a scam without you guys needing to say anything about evidence, they'll just believe it. I definitely want to make sure that my audience is being as informed as possible when they're making their decisions and deciding, you know, where they want to put their energy. The other topic, the sort of final topic I would like to get into is, because this comes down to what people believe in terrain theory versus germ theory. And I think I might have asked you this last time we talked, Andy, but is there some combination or some balance between there? Because it's just my non-scientific, uneducated opinion that it seems to me that our bodies and our health can be affected by both, by external stimuli and by, you know, the terrain, as well as being exposed to whatever name you want to give them, pathogens, et cetera. But again, that could be me being ignorant. But I feel like it doesn't necessarily seem in my research that it would have to be one or the other. Is there some balance between germ theory and terrain theory, or am I totally off base there?
Yeah, Derek, that's a really good question. And you know, this all is, it's such a sea change of the way that you think about these things that it takes some time to wrap your head around it and start thinking about things in a different way. But I want to just, you know, say that I used to believe in germ theory. Right, my whole life practically. I mean, it's only really pretty recent that I questioned these things at this level. And I prescribed antibiotics in my career as a physician many times. And so, you know, I was acting on the principle, and I observed things happen, and I interpreted it as supporting germ theory and contagion, and all the things that I'm saying at present don't have a true scientific basis. So, you know, and I know that I don't have all the answers now either. So what I would encourage any viewers to do is to just ask the questions yourself and go try to find the answers. And, you know, you may disagree with my interpretation. And if you have another way to interpret the experiments, like, please, I'd like to have a discussion about that. But with terrain theory, I think it is, in a way, the opposite of germ theory. Because it says that the microorganisms are really your friend. But that's not the whole story, because there are situations where they can get out of control, even based in a terrain theory model. But I want to just say two things to start off to make this more accessible. One is that terrain theory is already familiar to us because we know about the microbiome, right? The gut bacteria that we have all learned in recent years how important it is to our health. That is terrain theory. So terrain theory just takes that to its logical conclusion, and that's really what it comes from, and I'll explain that in a second. But the other aspect is that looking at microorganisms in a terrain theory model, you see them as being what's known as saprophytes, or having a saprophytic role. And this is the role that microorganisms have in the outside of our bodies. And we can all observe this and see. And what it means is basically they recycle dead organic material, right? So a limb falls off a tree, an animal dies, whatever it is, microorganisms come and eat that material and turn it back into the primary nutrients and elements that then rejoin the ecosystem and allow new life to be reborn. And what we're really saying with terrain theory is that that's what's happening with the microorganisms in our body as well. And so that when we have an insult to our tissue, right, which is the cause of a disease, and it's really just a few categories, like there's trauma of physical damage to our tissue, there's exposure to toxic material, which can come from our own metabolism or come from other sources. And then there's a deficiency. Oh, by the way, the toxic material can also be emotional or spiritual in the nature. And then, or we have a deficiency in, you know, some kind of nutritional factor that our body can't function. And when the damage from one of those factors occurs, then there is basically damaged tissue in our body. And the microorganisms are called upon to come from other areas of our body to that site where there's damaged tissue and basically eat up that the damaged tissue and debris and dead stuff so that the that area of the body can then renew and function you know, perfectly again. And that's essentially terrain theory. Now, there are situations where the body can't clean itself up for whatever reason. Like there's no exit strategy for the damaged or toxic material to be removed. Or there's more and more things coming into the body such that as soon as it can be removed, it's reaccumulated and it keeps causing damage to the tissue. Now, in this kind of a situation, microorganisms may stick around because they keep trying to clean it up, but they can't, and it may lead to a chronic condition. But the microorganisms may cause the symptoms. In other words, they eat this damaged debris, and then their waste products cause inflammation, which causes discomfort and pain and secretions. They may cause those symptoms, but those symptoms are actually trying to heal the area, right? So it's, in other words, it's not causing the illness per se, but it can't resolve because the situation underneath is unresolvable. And you have to then do something to help the body resolve that situation in order to resolve it. And it also shows how by killing those microorganisms that you will relieve the symptoms because they're caused by those factors that I mentioned. But that doesn't mean that the tissue or the illness underlying it is resolved. And this is why you often have recurrent infections when you use antibiotics, because the healing can't complete. It's interrupted by that kind of a toxic assault. So this is kind of really the terrain theory model. And, you know, we can apply it to specific situations. But what I've found over the last several years, and I found this to be true even before I understood the model of terrain theory, that when people use natural healing techniques to deal with especially chronic illnesses and serious illnesses, and they get better, the techniques that are successful fit the terrain theory paradigm. In other words, they support that process that I just described. They help those microorganisms do their work to resolve the condition. And that's where I've seen the success, and it really reinforces the model in, you know, for me personally.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Did you gentlemen have anything else you want to add as far as, you know, obviously we started this conversation to revisit some of the comments that were made by Dr. Mercola and the, you know, importance or lack of importance, depending on your view, of this particular part of the conversation. You know, people are beginning to understand that PCR tests are flawed. They're willing to accept that. But it does seem like many folks, and I'm speaking more of kind of maybe our friends and family who are more in the mainstream world outside of this information, have trouble being willing to go to this kind of leap. You know, they're willing to say, okay, maybe there's problems with the test. Yeah, there could be false positives, but I'm not sure I'm ready to think that the whole paradigm I've been taught from birth is false. And obviously we see that in a lot of different areas, but just any closing thoughts that you guys would like to share as far as this conversation or what Dr. Mercola said?
I only keep thinking if we're not ready to see what's actually the case, then we don't really have a chance to resolve this.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's important to ask the questions and really fully understand. And, you know, just really hearing that there's a possibility that there may not really be a virus or a microscopic invisible agent causing the disease from, you know, someone who at least has put some thought into it, right? Like, because you might criticize Tom and I in many ways and, or even our credentials, and we're not virologists, et cetera. But you can for sure tell that we've put some time and thought into this, right? And so I would say that would be a worthwhile endeavor for you to try and ask the same questions and not just trust our opinion, but use your own intellect and discrimination, and, right, to and discernment to say, you know, is this really a possibility? Like, can anyone really give a good argument to say that this virus does exist? Has anyone done that? Has anyone, in response to what we've said, like, come on and said, in this experiment, this particular technique shows it conclusively? Like, no, I'm not aware of anyone that's done that. No one has certainly sent me that. And if that existed, I'd be like the same with Tom. I'd be happy to recant, you know, everything that I've said, because I've changed my viewpoint already 180 degrees simply by taking the time to read and understand the papers that give the evidence that these claims are based upon. So that's all really that I ask people to do. Anyone in your audience, any other doctor who's concerned about this, take the time to look at the paper and then, you know, tell me what you think after that.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Tom, would you like to go ahead and just share the name of your book and where people can find it? Because I know it's really related to our whole conversation today.
Yeah, the book is called The Contagion Myth. It was banned by Amazon. It became the number one book on Barnes & Noble. And then amazingly, apparently the first time our publisher ever discovered or ever heard of, Barnes & Noble stopped ranking the book.
Oh. Eric, you're muted.
Anyway. Well, yeah, I heard you say that Barnes & Noble delisted it or deranked it.
No, they still carried it, but they stopped ranking it. So, and I think it's because it's ranked in the top, whatever, 10 or 100, then like the New York Times has to review it or something. I don't know exactly, but anyways, they stopped ranking it. But you can go to drtomcowan.com and there, anything you want to know about me is right there.
Awesome. And Andy, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on andrewkaufmanmd.com. That's Andrew, K-A-U-F as in Frank, M-A-N, M-D, like medical doctor, .com.
All right. Thank you guys so much for your time. And I hope everybody who listened to this conversation gained something out of it. And I want to reiterate what Dr. Kaufman was saying, and both of you, I think, were reiterating, is that think for yourself, question, you know, question the medical authorities, question me, question everybody, and do the research for yourself. Both these men do have a wealth of knowledge on this topic. I encourage you to check out their work. And until next time, guys, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.